19 degrees Kenosha, 18 in Racine, wind chill is minus 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be learning about the work of home inspectors, what they do and how they do it. And in part two, we're going to be remembering Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, whose funeral is later today. Here's part one. I'm excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because we're going to be talking about something that, in my long history of doing this program, we have never talked about before. In fact, I don't think we've even gone near the really intriguing topic of home inspections. That is, when one is about to buy a home, that process by which a home that you're thinking about buying is inspected by an unbiased third party who are experts in doing exactly that, inspecting a home from top to bottom, side to side, trying to assess its worth, potential problems, and so on. And for anybody who has gone through this process, whether you are buying or selling, you maybe have some understanding of just how complicated it is. But nobody understands the process better than my three morning show guests, Sal, Paul, and David Catanese. Sal is the father, Paul and David, two sons, and they own and operate a Mundelein-based family business called Legacy Inspection Group, and they have been doing home inspections for a long, long time. In fact, Sal Catanese, the father, has inspected over 30,000 homes in his long career in this business, and we're going to be talking with them about at least some of the aspects of this work, how important it is, and for someone who secures a home inspection team to take care of this, what do they need to be thinking about? So we'll cover a whole lot in the next few minutes. And Sal, Paul, David Catanese, we welcome you to the morning show.
We're glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
So happy to be talking with you. I would love to talk with Father Sal Catanese first to just find out a little bit about how this business got off the ground. When and under what circumstances did you create Legacy Inspection Group?
Greg, thank you for having us on here. I started it in 1995. It's just a quick clarification here. I have not done personally 30,000 inspections. If I did, I'd be dead. As a company, though, we've done over 30,000 inspections as we put together a team approach to inspecting, and we've got a good group of inspectors. So over the course of the last 28 years, we've done over 30,000 inspections as a company.
Very good.
Question, if for maybe the older people listening, the original idea with the when buying a home was buyer beware. You bought it, moved in, and you discovered that there's issues there. A lot of times those were minor issues. But what happened over time, and people were having problems when they were having major issues that felt were hidden, or they were not giving an honest evaluation of the home. And so that's where this business of home inspections came in. To try and counter that, basically the home inspections have been going on for the last 90 years, but typically it was only people with a lot of money could afford to hire an electrician, a plumber, a roofer, a contractor to come in and look at the home before they bought it. So that process was extremely expensive. The home inspection industry came in the late mid-70s where they felt, look, everybody should have that opportunity. And so our profession was created to give everybody the opportunity to have a non-biased party come in and take a look at the home beforehand, determine if maybe there needs to be further evaluation, that issues are found or directly find the issue, and able to give everybody the opportunity to have the home looked at before they bought it. I started in 1995 looking to change careers. At that time, I was a teacher, college level, high school level for years, but was looking to do something differently. I had a friend in real estate who kind of informed me about this, and so back in 1995, I started the business by myself, and in 2000, my son Paul came on with me as we started to grow, and then in 2002, Dave came, and that kind of started it to where in the beginning of getting to where we are right now. But the idea behind the whole business was to create a company that could provide good, solid, unbiased information for a home buyer so they could make a good decision moving forward on the purchase of a home.
Very well put. Paul and David, was it just a no-brainer to climb aboard your father's business? I mean, to follow in his footsteps?
This is Paul, Greg. I would say, I would say I've been to school and I just didn't want to, an everyday office job. It was not my personality. It was, I like to work with people. I like to be out and about, and it kind of, it kind of was a no-brainer for me. I wouldn't have been happy sitting in an office, 40 hours a week doing it. I would say it was a no-brainer. He gave me the opportunity to come aboard. He was just starting to grow, the opportunity was there, and we've kind of taken it and ran with it.
Hey, Greg, this is Dave here. Yeah, I actually came on when Sal started doing the training school for the state. And as that evolved, we needed websites and stuff like that. So I originally started doing more technical stuff like websites and then hopped in doing actual field work and inspections too. So for me, it was kind of, there was a need that needed to be filled, and I hopped in to do that.
Mm. And, I had not really stopped to think about it, but I can't think of a better example of a job in which no two jobs are exactly the same. I mean, I should think that every time you walk into a house, I mean, it is its own challenge. And of course, you've probably had some adventures and some misadventures in terms of the kind of places you've inspected. And maybe we'll take a little time for those sorts of stories. On your website, you make mention of the fact of a state requirement. And this might be something maybe specifically, I would assume it's specifically in place in Illinois. Maybe it's not in effect in other places. But it says something about how the state requires the buyer to sign a pre-inspection agreement specifying what will and will not be done during an inspection. I'm curious, first of all, if that is just one or if there are a lot of regulations when it comes to this matter of home inspection. And what is the main point of this pre-inspection agreement that must be signed?
This is Sal again, Greg. In Illinois and also up in Wisconsin, licensed to do this job, you have to be licensed. And I think it came from the state just saying, hey, this is quite an important feature of the home buying process, and they want to make sure there's at least some background and some controls over who's doing it, make sure they're properly trained and educated. Part of the reason we got into the education part of this business with our inspection school so that we are training people to do it. And one of the requirements the state did was say, hey, we need to sign a pre-inspection agreement. What a pre-inspection agreement is, it's a good business practice when both the client and the purveyor, ourselves, are on the same page, have the same expectations. And that's really what a pre-inspection agreement is. It lays out, we lay out for the client what we're going to do, okay, what is going to happen during the course of the inspection, and what maybe limitations there are, so that the client knows, and part of our requirement is to make sure people have this document well ahead of the inspection, so they really know what we're about to do, what we're proposed to do, and what limitations there are, and then make sure that everybody's on the same page, which can save a lot of problems later on.
Hmm. So when you go into a home, it's obviously impossible to thoroughly inspect every single cubic inch of a whole home. Generally speaking, what is your sort of list of important tasks that must always be done in every typical home inspection?
Well, this is Sal one more time here. Basically, it's almost the state lists the important elements, but also if the people will check on their real estate contract, the real estate community is also listed. And what we want to focus on is the major systems, the roof, the plumbing, the heating, the electric, the structure, and then what we call the livability issues in a home, what it's going to be like for a client once or a person once they buy the home and move in, water pressure, drainage, safety features, to make sure they're all there. So that's kind of the big focus, to make sure the big items, they're not going to get hurt on, and that also living in this home is a safe environment for them and their family.
Hmm. I noticed that on your website, and there's probably, this might be true of other home inspection firms as well, there's a list of some very specific things like radon testing, sewer scoping, mold testing, chimney scoping. Are those kind of things done typically in a home inspection, or are those tests that are done maybe under more special or unique circumstances?
Yeah, great question, Greg. And this has evolved greatly over the past few years. It used to be everyone just did a general inspection. Now buyers are wanting more than that. Chimney inspection, if the house has a fireplace, they want a camera run through the chimney. Radon testing, checking the home for radon gas. The biggest one lately is sewer scoping. People are moving into homes, finding roots and breaks in their sewer line. It's a really expensive problem. Really popular lately is people preemptive of that problem are getting the sewer scope with a camera. So those are all services that have come up over the last few years.
There's an interesting little line of advice on your website that I really would love to hear you expand on. So this is advice for somebody who is securing your services or the services of another home inspection firm. And that is, do not miss the forest for the trees. It's a really interesting turn of phrase. I'm sure we've all heard that familiar phrase, but how does that apply to the matter of having a home inspected before you buy it? Why do we have to be careful about this matter of forest and trees?
Right. Greg, this is Paul. We put that saying up there. When you're buying it, when people typically buy a new house, it can be really overwhelming, right? Our job as consultants is to kind of get them to say, hey, the color of the paint doesn't necessarily matter, but your roof or your foundation or your heating and cooling system, those are the things that matter. You can live in a house with ugly paint. You can't live in a house with no water, or a bad foundation or a leaky roof. So we always try and get our clients to kind of see the importance of certain things in a house. And cosmetic things typically are not them. Most people go in, paint, change their carpet, have plans to remodel a kitchen. No one really has plans to put a new foundation on a house or move in, the roof leaks, and they've got to, spend a lot of money on a new roof. Because those things you need to live in the house. You can live in with ugly paint all you want.
You also say on the website that the buyer, if possible, should be present for the home inspection. Tell us why that can be helpful for the buyer to be actually on hand, on site. I mean, did I read that correctly? Am I remembering that correctly?
You're 100% correct. And that's 50% of the inspection, Greg, is working with the buyer, educating them. If they're not there and they just get a report, the report can be overwhelming. A good inspector is going to work with the client, address their needs, and really listen to their questions. Very important.
And we want to make sure also it's nice to point out to them when, as opposed to, let's say we found a list of 40 problems in there and 38 of them are about broken doorknobs. When we're there, we can focus on, hey, this is the important thing in this report. We need to show it to you. So they're not making an interpretation of something they did not see. So we always encourage them to be there. It's a better inspection with our clients there with us when we're doing this because, again, they can get the full idea of what's going on in this house when they move in.
The report that you give, and at one point on your website you talk about what ends up being presented to the potential buyer is a balanced, unemotional report without bias and so on. In the typical report, do you ultimately then make some sort of final conclusion, like go ahead and buy this house, or under no circumstances should you buy this house, or is that not part of your job? I mean, is your job just to present results and have the prospective buyer make their own conclusions?
100%. We let them make their own conclusions. You know, I think we can emphasize things in the report and we can, you know, prioritize things, but the ultimate conclusion of whether to move forward with the purchase or what to request the seller repairs is up to them because everyone's situation is different. So, yeah, we leave that up to them.
You are not only in the business of inspecting homes, but of training home inspectors and have been doing that important work for many, many years. One thing really intrigued me, I don't remember where I saw this, but some kind of reference to how you like to put together or design your home inspection teams to be a little like sports teams. So I'm wondering, I mean, are we talking about a sports-focused family of athletes? And what exactly are you talking about in terms of this, how you put your teams together? How does that relate to the world of sports or athletics?
You know, well, you know, I wouldn't say any of us are great athletes, but we do enjoy watching sports. But, you know, we look at we typically do an inspection with a team, all right? Our inspectors go out in groups, all right? And like any team, you've got people that have strengths and you have people that have weaknesses, right? But what we need to do is we need to get them all to be one cohesive unit and work through a house and perform at the highest level. And so what we do is we want to put together people that work well together, that communicate well together, that help each other, important, and communicate well. So what we do in Legacy, what we do is when we put together an inspection team, we look for all different attributes and we see about managing those and so we have a great product, a great service that we put out, and you know, the teams are strong, and that's kind of what we want to do. On a daily basis, we do that.
So when you are going into homes, what are some of the sort of especially amazing or maybe horrifying things that you end up seeing?
You know, this is Sal again, and I got to jump in with my all-time home inspection story. This is Paul and I were doing a house, and Paul and I had just read a book about the Ebola virus and how it's carried by monkeys. And so we're doing a house, and we went into the house, and the first thing we noticed was there was a little, like, doggy door in the back of the house, but running in and out of the house were certainly dogs, but also pigs. So we're in the house, and there's pigs running in and out of the house. And so, okay, I guess people like pigs, but I was doing something in the basement. Paul called me, says, come on upstairs, you got to see this. And we opened the door to a bedroom, and it was a wall of monkeys. There were cages in the house. There were six cages, and each case was a cage was a monkey. And so that kind of did shock me, especially having read about the Ebola virus and how it's transmitted through monkeys. So that was probably the most amazing thing I think I had ever seen in a home in 30 years of doing this.
That's hey, Greg,
I think yes. What was called the house, if I recall correctly.
Wow. So a last really important matter, which is the matter of trust. At one point on your website, you say to the prospective buyer, you must trust the home inspector. If you don't, they're the wrong person for you. Explain that matter of trust and the way in which you, for instance, try to foster that sense of trust, of being trustworthy when it comes to an important matter. I mean, an incredibly important matter like this. I mean, for most people, this is by far the largest purchase they will ever make in their lives.
Yeah, I think this is Sal again. I think that goes with the idea of why we always strongly recommend the client attend the inspection with us. We want to create this give and take atmosphere in there, that we're not some thing or some entity that's on the phone or sending you a report. No, we want to go through the house. We encourage them to ask questions. We try when we're going, explain how the home functions. You may have a perfect home, but what the client can pick up from us is how this home works, where the safety features are, shutoffs, the operation of the home. So we're trying to create a rapport with them. And we want to point out an issue and explain not only what the issue is, but what the ramifications of that issue may be with the buyer. So we want them, when they leave there, to say, boy, I've got a really good knowledge. I've been with someone who took the time to look at my house that I'm going to buy and answer my questions to hopefully help me so I understand the home I'm buying. And I can move forward. And basically, when they're done with the inspection, what they're saying to us is, look it, I will trust you in this really expensive process. And once that's there and they do trust you, it works out nicely. One of the things we try to do with Legacy is if after they move in, they have questions or needed something else to be looked at, we want to respond to them. And if need be, we're going to go back out there and basically, because you did put that trust in us, we want to make sure we can make this whole process not only at pre-purchase but after purchase work for them.
Hmm. Sal, Paul, and David Catanese operate Legacy Inspection Group. Their website gives a whole lot of interesting information. And for anybody who is embarking on this important venture, wherever you might be, looking at their website, I think will give you a lot to think about in terms of the important matters that are worth considering in securing a home inspection firm and the things one should be thinking about as you embark on this this really big step. Sal, Paul, David Catanese, it's been really fun to speak with you about the important work that you and your staff do. Thank you for making time for the morning show, and best wishes to all of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Later today is the funeral of Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. Her tenure as an Associate Justice from 1981 to 2006 coincided with some of the most turbulent times in recent American political history. And Justice O'Connor was often as regarded as the pivotal justice on the court as it grappled with some of its most important cases. Back in July, I was privileged to record an interview with award-winning documentarian Michelle Ferrari, co-producer, writer, and director of an outstanding installment in the PBS series American Experience, a documentary titled Sandra Day O'Connor, The First, based in large measure on Evan Thomas's marvelous book, First, Sandra Day O'Connor. This film, by the way, can be viewed on the PBS website, pbs.org. Was this your idea or someone else's idea for a film to be done about Sandra Day O'Connor?
I must confess that it was someone else's idea. American Experience had optioned the book upon which the film is based, which is sort of our title reversed. It's called The First Sandra Day O'Connor, and that's by Evan Thomas. And when I was finishing up my last film, The Vote, they brought this idea to me. But I was thrilled, as always, to be working on it. I was, of course, aware of Sandra Day O'Connor when she was nominated to the Supreme Court. I was at an age when I was sort of just becoming aware of the wider world. And certainly in the decades that followed, I followed court decisions that I took an interest in, but I didn't know anything about her personally. And, you know, that's one of the great gifts and privileges of my job. You start a project knowing next to nothing about a person or an event, and by the end of the project, I wouldn't say you're an expert, but you can at least carry on a cogent conversation with an expert, and that's really incredibly rewarding.
The film begins with news footage as she is arriving for her confirmation hearings, and then there is an excerpt from an interview in which she's talking to, I forget if it's Charlie Rose or somebody else, but she kind of takes him to task, somewhat good-naturedly, for how he and others in the media were actually spending way too much time, in a sense, talking about her or talking about matters other than the heart of the matter, as far as she was concerned. I think that's a really great way to open the film because it gives us a little peek inside who she was, how she thought, and the way she expressed herself, which was certainly very engaging. Tell us more about this little moment that we see right at the outset of your film.
Well, I will say that even before I read Evan's book, I watched that Charlie Rose interview, and I was just captivated by her. I loved her dry wit and the way she resisted any attempt to interpret or spin her experience. I felt like her personal attributes, her charm, her social intelligence were really on full display, and I knew I wanted to weave that interview in and out of the film. And that moment in particular that you're referencing, she is indeed taking Rose and the rest of the media to task for paying far too much attention to her. I mean, she was certainly aware that her appointment was symbolic, that it, you know, meant a great deal to women, particularly in the legal profession. But she really wanted to get down to the work at hand, and she wanted to be known for the work that she did on the bench, and the sort of moniker of the first woman on the Supreme Court, I think, became heavy for her to carry after a certain point. You know, and of course, it was a big deal. She was the first woman in 191 years to sit on the Supreme Court. So, of course, the media was going to pay attention, but she wanted to get on to business.
Right. She's called at one point in the film the most talked about judicial nominee in American history, at least up to that point. And your film reminds us that there was actually gavel-to-gavel televised coverage of her confirmation hearings, which I don't believe had ever happened before. And your film also shows us, and this is also towards the beginning, that there were ferocious protests against her and her nomination at that point in time. I mean, she hadn't even yet sat on the bench or rendered a single decision, but there was already widespread concern from a certain swath of the public in terms of Sandra Day O'Connor taking this position on the U.S. Supreme Court. So there is a lot that is swirling around her at this moment in her life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, first of all, she was the most talked about judicial nominee in history, in part because her hearings were televised. And the hearings were televised in part because she was a woman and there was a lot of interest around the issue, but also because of the new medium of cable news. There was just a lot of coverage of her confirmation in a way that there hadn't been before. I mean, we're accustomed now to seeing these confirmation hearings on television, but that was an entirely new thing. And then the protest that you speak of, it was certainly adamant. I would say at that point it was relatively contained. It came from a faction, what was then a small faction of the Republican Party, far to the right, and, you know, deeply opposed to many of the decisions that had been made by the Warren Court under Earl Warren. Liberal decisions, in particular Roe v. Wade. But in 1981, I wouldn't say that that faction had a stranglehold on the party quite yet.
Hmm. Your film explores her background, being raised in rural Arizona, and the point is made that one really learns self-reliance when you grow up in a place like that. And of course, self-reliance ends up being one of the hallmarks of her personality. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. She grew up on a 160,000-acre cattle ranch in southeastern Arizona, and for the first many years of her life, she was the only child around. So it was her and her parents and the ranch hands. And she learned very early on to look after herself and to chip in. Everybody had their part to play on the ranch. At one point she was tasked, when she was about 14 or 15 years old, with bringing lunch to the ranch hands who were out working the roundup. And she and her mother prepared the lunch, and she loaded it into the Willie's Jeep, which she had learned to drive as soon as she could see over the dashboard. She drove out alone onto this, you know, untracked, unpaved, untenanted ranch and got a flat tire and had to change the tire herself and got to the roundup quite late, the meeting spot quite late. And, you know, she was proud of herself for having changed the tire. And when her father said, "You're late," she said, "Well, Dad, I got a flat tire and I fixed it." And he said, "Next time, leave earlier." And I think the message from, you know, that very early part of her life was that you're responsible and you have to take responsibility. And if it's on your plate, you have to finish it.
We're talking to Michelle Ferrari, writer, producer, director of the American Experience film Sandra Day O'Connor, The First, which is airing this coming Monday night. She was exceptionally intelligent, skipped two grades of school, enrolled at Stanford at the age of 16, and ultimately went to law school. Ultimately there met and married John O'Connor, who was also a lawyer. And their marriage was uncommon in a lot of different ways. And chances are Sandra Day O'Connor, for as brilliant as she was, would not have gone on to do what she did had she not had a life partner like John O'Connor. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but can you just say a quick word about their marriage and their partnership, life partnership, and what a difference that made in terms of what she was ultimately able to achieve?
I think it made an enormous difference, as you said. Certainly, when they married in the early 1950s, you know, women's roles were fairly prescribed, and most men of their class would have expected their wives to stay home and raise the children and take care of the house. But they had a relationship of equals. John was very, very aware of how gifted Sandra was. And he supported her in whatever she wanted to do, to the extent that when she was confirmed to the Supreme Court, he essentially gave up his work for hers.
She, for a time, left the law in part because of the frustration of not having the kind of vibrant legal career that her smarts and credentials warranted. But it was, I guess, a time when it was quite uncommon for women to be lawyers. And so maybe that was part of why she, for a time, went into politics. I mean, was actually in her state legislature. Tell us what you think is the significance of this relatively brief chapter in her life and career.
You know, I I wouldn't think of it, or wouldn't say that she left the law. She wanted to be a lawyer in the Senate. She was interested in state government. She'd become quite involved with the Republican Party at that point. She'd been a precinct committee person and had a lot of connections in the Republican Party. And I think she was just interested in how the law and the legislature, you know, intersected. She wanted to have that experience. She was a very curious person, and she had this opportunity. She had Republican connections. There was an open seat vacated midterm, and she kind of got herself appointed to that seat. I think, you know, she really learned a lot about people and getting things done when she was in the Arizona Senate. And she was a very effective negotiator and very well liked by her peers on both sides of the aisle. I think that really kind of molded the kind of justice she would become on the Supreme Court. Mm.
One of the things I especially appreciate about your film is how it takes us back to the days of the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, ultimately did not come to be. And Sandra Day O'Connor was caught right in the middle of that very, very hotly contested a division in our country. And she makes a decision about, in a sense, letting ERA die in the state of Arizona, just believing that there was that was its destiny anyway. But she went about accomplishing other things that would have perhaps happened with ERA in her own way. Explain what she goes about doing with the laws of the state of Arizona from that point on.
As any one of her biographers would probably tell you, you know, what she does is very Sandra Day O'Connor, which is to say she kind of makes an end run around the fractious politics, the backlash against the ERA, the fact that she doesn't have sufficient votes in her caucus to get the measure to, out of committee. And instead, she just goes through the statutes in Arizona and one by one targets each of the ones that treat women unequally and gets those laws changed. Winds up leaving Arizona women in a more equal position than they would have been without her presence, certainly, and brings to them many of the legal protections that the ERA would have had it passed.
The question is posed more than once in your film of whether or not Sandra Day O'Connor was a feminist, and the label was something from which she recoiled a bit. But the answer to that seemingly simple question is a little bit complicated, and what you were just talking about is kind of folded into that, isn't it?
I mean, I think there's no question that she was a feminist in the sense that, you know, she believed that no one should be prevented from doing what they were capable of doing by virtue of their gender or race, for that matter, or she didn't really care for boxes. She didn't like the idea of people being put into boxes. But she did not identify as a feminist, in part as one of her former clerks, her very first clerk on the Supreme Court, actually says in the film, in part because she saw feminists as people who were protesting in the street, and that's not who she was. She was, you know, a much more sort of moderate, measured person. And she didn't live in the world of bra burning, although we know no bras were burned, but still. I think she just didn't want to associate herself with that kind of radical action.
Explain why there was such ferocious concern from some over her nomination to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, by the time we get to 1981, the backlash against Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that, you know, guaranteed a right to abortion, was really picking up steam. In 1976, John Paul Stevens was confirmed, unanimously confirmed to the Supreme Court without being asked a single question about abortion. But by 1981, we're in a place where the backlash is mounting, the forces are gathering in opposition, the pro-life movement is gaining ground and gaining political power. And they really made a big noise about O'Connor's nomination, in part because she had signaled her support for the Equal Rights Amendment early on in Arizona before withdrawing it when she realized she would have to expend too much political capital. And then also she had cast an unrecorded vote to decriminalize abortion in Arizona. And this was regarded as, evidence that she was at least tolerant of abortion, if not in favor of it. And, you know, the pro-life faction of the Republican Party had basically supported Ronald Reagan on the premise that he would appoint anti-abortion judges to the court. So O'Connor was seen as anathema. But as I said before, you know, the divisions hadn't really solidified yet, and the pro-life movement was the Christian conservatives were yet a faction of the Republican Party, and so even though they made a big noise, it wound up being something of a tempest in a teapot, and O'Connor was confirmed unanimously. No one wanted to cross the new president. There was too much to be done.
Your film suggests at least one possible reason why Ronald Reagan had pledged to nominate a woman to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Explain what at least part of his reason very likely was.
Well, you know, in keeping with all of this backlash and the rise of the Christian right, et cetera, the Republican Party had really done kind of an about-face in 1980 at their nominating convention, which is to say that they had been the first party to endorse the Equal Rights Amendment and had long had a kind of open policy about Roe v. Wade, about abortion rights. And at the 1980 convention, they withdraw support for both, formally dismiss the Equal Rights Amendment and make this pledge to appoint anti-abortion judges at all levels. And they had real concern, Reagan's team had real concern, that they were going to lose the votes of college-educated women in the bargain. Reagan was down in the polls with women in the swing state of Illinois, for example. And so he made this kind of literally campaign bus decision to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court, to nominate a woman to the Supreme Court, and announced that he would do so if elected president. And it was a pretty cynical move, I think, at the time. But very soon after taking office, he had a chance to do just that because a justice retired. And Sandra Day O'Connor's name was already on a list because she was by that point quite well connected.
Right. And of course she is confirmed. She does take her place on the U.S. Supreme Court, the first woman in our history. And moreover, and I guess this is in so many ways kind of the central point of your film, is that although we should not underestimate the significance of a woman at last, at long last, sitting on the Supreme Court. In a sense, what is far more significant is not her gender, but the role that she ends up playing on the Supreme Court during some very tumultuous years when she is seen as the pivotal figure on that case. One headline says, since she was calling the shots, another headline calls it the O'Connor Court. Just explain the dynamics of what was going on there that made her so significant.
Well, as the court itself became more polarized, she increasingly was holding the center of gravity. Over the course of her tenure, the ideological fault lines in this country began to solidify and harden. But O'Connor was always a person who could see nuance, who looked for nuance. And I think, you know, I was both impressed and intrigued by her style on the bench, by her vision of the court's role in American life, and her penchant, I would say even her gift, for building consensus, which increasingly seems to me a lost art. But she was the swing vote, and she did not cling to any fixed ideological notions. And as a result, she was able to kind of broker broker consensus among her peers, so that the law did not swing wildly in one direction or another. I have nothing but respect for revolutionaries, you know, for people who are willing to go to extremes in defense of a principle or a vision for the future. But I also think that in a nation of nearly 300 million people, there's a real need for compromise, for people who pull toward the middle. I think, you know, most Americans, at least not when not faced with a stark either-or choice, tend to see those complexities themselves, tend to see the complexities of some of our sort of more controversial issues, and tend to be moderate. And I think O'Connor was a justice in that mold.
Right. And for many years, she sat on a Supreme Court in which there were four staunch conservatives and four staunch liberals. And there she sat in the middle. I mean, willing and able to pivot between them. And at one point in your film, there's a really kind of neat graphic as we're taken through various cases before the Supreme Court, and we're shown visually with whom Justice O'Connor voted. And in certain cases, it was with those conservatives. In other cases, it was with the liberals. And you had a long succession of 5-4 decisions. And in essentially every case, it is Sandra Day O'Connor who decides which direction it goes. It's such an important part of her extraordinary legacy. A last quick question. She, of course, is still alive, but in her early 90s. Were you able to directly connect with her in any way in the making of this film?
Sadly, I was not. I did not have the privilege of meeting her or talking to her. She has, you know, officially retired from public life. But I was very fortunate to speak with her son, Scott. And I, you know, spent a great many hours watching interviews with her and footage of her, much of which is in the film, and did feel that I came to know her in some small way. And hope that audiences feel similarly.
Michelle Ferrari was co-producer, writer, and director of the American Experience documentary film Sandra Day O'Connor, The First. The film can be viewed free of charge at pbs.org. Justice O'Connor's funeral will be later today. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, two delicious interviews, if you will. The first with Tanaya Darlington, who is also known as Madame Fromage, one of our country's leading experts on everything related to cheese. Her newest book is called Madame Fromage's Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair it and love it, from the creamiest brie to the funkiest blues. We'll pair with that an interview with Matt Horanek, author of a really stunningly beautiful new cookbook called A Man and His Kitchen. On Thursday, two interesting interviews related to the world of professional basketball. Mitchell S. Jackson has written a book called Fly, The Big Book of Basketball Fashion. And Russ Bengston will talk about his interesting book called A History of Basketball in 50.